The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. The next half hour, I'll be reading articles initially from the Harvard Heart Letter. This is the Harvard Heart Letter of November 2024. And the first article is entitled, What is Your Brain Care Score? This 21-point quiz can help you identify proven, actionable steps to reduce your risk of stroke, dementia, and depression. After someone receives a devastating diagnosis of stroke or dementia, family members inevitably have many questions. The one question I get all the time is, what can I do to take good care of my brain so I don't end up like this, says Dr. Jonathan Rosend, professor of neurology at Harvard Medical School. So he collaborated with patients and colleagues at Massachusetts General Hospital's McCants Center for Brain Health to create the McCants Brain Care Score. The measurement, the first of its kind, tallies points from 12 physical, lifestyle, and social-emotional domains. It was validated using data from nearly 400,000 adults aged 40 through 69 who were followed an average of 12.5 years. The study, published November 30, 2023 by Frontiers in Neurology, found that people who scored higher at the start of the study had lower risks of developing stroke or dementia over time. Each year, more than 795,000 people suffer a stroke in the United States, and dementia affects 1 in 7 Americans. The results varied by age group, with more dramatic drops among people younger than 50, compared to those age 59 and older. But the benefits were still evident for people in their 60s. A 5-point higher score was linked to a 33% lower risk of stroke. A subsequent study found that higher scores were also associated with a lower risk of depression over time. The findings support earlier evidence, showing that it's never too late to raise your brain care score, says Dr. Rosend. While the impact may be greater when you're younger, it's still substantial when you're older. And if you've already had a stroke or have early cognitive decline, raising your score is likely to reduce the risk of another stroke and might even slow the rate of your cognitive decline. Every 4 years, someone in the United States dies from a stroke-related cause. Every 4 minutes, someone in the United States dies from a stroke-related cause. Yet at least 60% of strokes are preventable by changing behaviors, habits, and other risk factors that contribute to stroke. Among the most potent of these are not smoking and keeping your blood pressure below 120 over 80. Both factors net 3 points on the brain care score. What's more, the same things that benefit your brain are also closely linked to lower risk for heart disease and heart failure, as well as many cancers, including those of lung, breast, and colon. As those of us who focus on brain health like to say, take care of your brain, and the rest of your body will follow. Heart attacks and strokes are two main examples of problems affecting the vascular system, the network of blood vessels in the body and brain. Another is vascular dementia, which stems from the degeneration of blood vessels in the brain, often from a series of tiny strokes. The symptoms include slowed thinking, confusion, problems with attention, concentration, and organization. Vascular dementia differs from Alzheimer's disease, which results from brain cell degeneration, Dr. Rosen explains. However, the two conditions often occur together, and Alzheimer's disease is exacerbated by vascular dementia. In fact, it's often difficult to say for certain whether a person has Alzheimer's or vascular dementia. The good news is that a higher brain care score appears to help prevent both types. The brain is a very metabolically active organ that demands rapid changes in blood supply from second to second, says Dr. Rosend. As a result, the brain's smallest vessels constantly dilate and contract to ensure that the regions of the brain that are active have the blood supply they need, while those that are at rest don't receive any more than they need. Over time, damage to these vessels leaves them prone to injury and deterioration. Known as cerebral small vessel disease, it's the most common precursor to vascular dementia. In a study published August 2024 in Neurology, Dr. Rosen and colleagues found that a higher brain care score was associated with less visible damage from cerebral small vessel disease. The study involved more than 34,000 middle-aged adults without a history of stroke or dementia who had brain MRI scans. The scans can reveal evidence of damage to small vessels, especially lesions in the brain white matter, which consists of bundles of nerve fibers that connect brain cells. The findings provide a physical sign that you can measure in the brain that's correlated to your lifestyle and the degree to which you're modifying your risk factors, says Dr. Rosen. Tallying up your brain care score helps you identify what you're doing right and pinpoint the areas you can improve. It doesn't matter where you start. Just pick one area that seems the easiest, says Dr. Rosen. One successful experience often leads people to try other changes. Where people live, what they have access to, and their unique lifestyles all influence what they're able to start changing. Dr. Rosen chats with his patients to help them figure out about what solutions might work best for them. For example, a patient who rarely ate vegetables acknowledged liking broccoli and eating it once a week. Why not eat it three times a week, Dr. Rosen suggested. It's not that much more effort to buy and cook a few extra servings. A different person whose job demanded long stretches of sitting realized he could add informal exercise to his daily routine by climbing the six flights of stairs to his apartment twice a day. You don't have to wear fancy exercise gear and go to a gym to meet the recommended exercise goals, says Dr. Rosen. Another man who was recently divorced didn't have many social relationships outside of work and his immediate family. We started talking about his old friends, which reminded him of his artistic aspirations during high school. Within 6 months, the man was taking painting lessons and meeting new people. Each of us can find ways to improve our brain score over time. The key is deciding that you really don't want to develop dementia or stroke and are eager to do something about it. And the article goes on to mention that the McCants Brain Care Score includes multiple choice options for four physical components: blood pressure, blood sugar, cholesterol, and body mass index; five lifestyle components: nutrition, alcohol intake, smoking, aerobic activities, and sleep; and three social-emotional components: stress management, social relationships, and meaning in life. The responses are assigned a point value, and these are added to determine the brain care score, with 21 the highest possible total. Higher scores mean better brain care. Now here's a section of the Harvard Heart Letter entitled Ask the Doctor by Dr. Christopher Cannon, who's the editor-in-chief of the Harvard Heart Letter. The question is, I take medication to treat my high blood pressure and high cholesterol, but I still feel chest pain whenever I walk uphill. A cardiac catheterization showed serious narrowing in all three of my main heart arteries. Should I receive stents, or would it be better to have bypass surgery? The answer is, chest discomfort that occurs with exercise, called stable angina, is quite common. About 500,000 cases are diagnosed in this country every year. As the testing you've had confirms, the pain you feel during exertion stems from the narrowing of your coronary arteries. The resulting reduced blood flow, which decreases the supply of oxygen to your heart muscle, leads to the discomfort. The medication you're taking are the first-line treatments for coronary artery disease. But as that article explains, and that's an article in the March 2024 Heart Letter, additional treatment makes sense when symptoms persist. Improving blood flow to your heart muscle, called revascularization, can be done in two ways, with stents or with bypass surgery. To place a stent, an interventional cardiologist passes the catheter through an artery in the upper thigh or the wrist, maneuvers the tiny mesh tube up to the heart, then opens the blocked vessel with a tiny balloon, using the stent to prop the artery open. The alternative is open heart surgery, in which a cardiac surgeon uses an artery or vein taken from elsewhere in the body to reroute blood around the blocked artery. This is known as coronary artery bypass grafting, also referred to as CABG or CABG or bypass surgery. In addition to relieving angina symptoms, another goal is to prevent a future heart attack or heart-related death. Large randomized trials comparing these two approaches have found that for most people, the results are similar in terms of future risk. People with diabetes and more than two narrowed arteries appear to have a lower risk of death with bypass surgery, though. For people without diabetes, the location and complexity of the blockages can be a factor. People with a blockage in the left main coronary artery are often, but not always, treated with bypass. Most hospitals take what's called the heart team approach, in which both an interventional cardiologist and a cardiac surgeon review the person's history and test results. Other health conditions, especially kidney disease, lung disease, and frailty, may affect their recommendations. Then they discuss their findings with the patient, explaining the risks and benefits of the different options. I urge you to seek out this approach, which is also referred to as shared decision making. And now, once again, in the Harvard Heart Letter of November 2024, here's an article called A Non-Drug Approach to Lower Blood Pressure. Called renal denervation, the technique targets nerves that supply the kidneys. Who is a candidate for this recently approved procedure? In 2023, the FDA approved two renal denervation systems for treating high blood pressure that can't be controlled with lifestyle change and medication. Both systems work by disrupting some of the nerves surrounding the renal arteries, which supply blood to the kidneys. One system uses ultrasound energy to target the nerves. The other uses radio frequency energy. A third system, still under review, uses alcohol. A typical blood pressure target is less than 130 over 80, but doctors may adjust that goal based on a person's other health conditions. One in seven people has what's called resistant hypertension, defined as a blood pressure that's above the goal despite the use of three or more blood pressure drugs, including a diuretic. These people are the most obvious candidates for renal denervation, according to the American Heart Association's scientific statement, which was published in August in Hypertension Journal. However, both systems are approved more broadly as add-on treatment for people whose blood pressure remains high, despite lifestyle changes and medications, even if they don't precisely meet the definition of resistant hypertension. The average person with hypertension needs 2 to 3 medications to reach their blood pressure target, says Dr. Randall Zussman, director of the Division of Hypertension at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. But some people need 4, 5, or even 6 different drugs to reach the goal, he adds. Some people who appear to have resistant hypertension simply aren't taking their drugs as prescribed. They're reluctant to use medications because of earlier experiences with unpleasant side effects, or they're already taking so many drugs they don't want to take additional ones, says Dr. Zussman. But potential candidates for renal denervation also include people currently just taking two drugs, or even just one, who cannot tolerate higher doses or additional medication. Renal denervation lowers systolic blood pressure, the first number in a reading, by an average of 8 to 9 points, about the same as what people get with a single blood pressure drug. But the response varies widely. Some people experience more dramatic drops, others have no response. So far, efforts to pinpoint why the procedure works better for certain people have been fruitless, and exactly how renal denervation works remains unclear. The latest evidence suggests the benefits persist for at least 3 years. For the procedure, a physician guides a thin, flexible catheter into a vessel at the top of the thigh and threads it through the blood vessels to the renal arteries. A tiny device at the catheter's tip disables some of the nerves leading to each kidney. The procedure is done under conscious sedation. You're drowsy and relaxed, but may feel some pain, and it takes about 45 minutes. Afterward, people stay in the hospital or surgery center for at least 6 hours and sometimes overnight. Most catheter-based treatment for heart problems are now done through an artery in the wrist, which leads to less bleeding and faster recovery. But the catheters in the currently available renal denervation devices aren't narrow or long enough to pass through the wrist down to the kidneys, says Dr. Joseph Garasik, medical director of the cardiac catheterization lab at Massachusetts General Hospital. However, catheters that would enable a wrist approach are in development and should be available within a year or two. For now, renal denervation is being performed only at major medical centers and those that participate in clinical trials of one of the devices. Right now, we're focusing on treating people with the greatest need. For example, someone with a systolic blood pressure of 180, despite taking 5 medications. But Dr. Garasik anticipates broader use of the technique in the coming years, especially after wrist catheters become available. In the future, I think doctors might use renal denervation in young people newly diagnosed with high blood pressure as an alternative to drug therapy, says Dr. Zussman. The next article from the Harvard Heart Letter is entitled, Calcium and Heart Disease, What's the Connection? One test doctors use to better understand a person's risk of heart disease is a coronary artery calcium scan, a special type of CT scan. The test measures the amount of calcium in the walls of the heart's arteries to generate a calcium score. The higher the score, the greater the risk of having a heart attack. Calcium makes up just a small part of the harmful buildup that narrows the heart's arteries. Plaque also contains cholesterol, inflammatory cells, and scar tissue, explains Dr. Randerson Cardoso, a cardiologist at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. On a CT scan, the cholesterol is not visible, but the calcium is easy to see. Because there's a close correlation between the amount of calcium and the amount of plaque, a calcium score is a good indicator of plaque inside the arteries. Still, you might wonder, as Dr. Cardoso's patients and others have, if calcium in your diet or from the supplements you take affects your calcium score. Research on this topic has been somewhat conflicting, but there is a study that was done in July of 2024 in JACC Advances that provides additional clarity. The findings come from 1,914 people from the diverse and long-running atherosclerosis risk in communities study, which recruited people aged 45 to 64 in the late 1980s. Researchers were able to estimate how much calcium the participants typically ate based on detailed diet questions done when they first enrolled, and again 10 years later. About 10 years after the start of the study, participants underwent CT scans that measured calcification in the coronary arteries, as well as in the aorta, aortic valve, and mitral valve, where calcium may also accumulate. Researchers found that people who consumed the highest amount of calcium had less calcification in their coronary arteries compared to people who consumed the lowest amount of calcium. These results are consistent with other well-done research that showed that dietary calcium is beneficial. Calcium helps to lower blood pressure, possibly by improving the function of the lining of the blood vessels. It's one reason the DASH diet, which stands for Dietary Approach to Hypertension, includes 2 servings of low-fat, calcium-rich dairy foods every day. According to diet surveys, many Americans, especially older adults, fall short of suggested calcium intake levels. The latest data suggests that people aged 60 and older consume an average of just 875 milligrams of calcium a day. 1,000 milligrams is recommended for men aged 51 to 70, and 1,200 for women 51 and older. I tell my patients to make sure they're getting adequate amounts of calcium from their diet, says Dr. Cardoso. In the United States, nearly 3/4 of dietary calcium comes from dairy products and foods featuring dairy. People who follow a vegan diet, which excludes dairy and other animal-based foods, may want to make sure to consult a dietitian to guarantee they're getting enough calcium, says Dr. Cardoso. However, many brands of almond milk, oat milk, or other plant-based milks are fortified with calcium. What about calcium supplements, which are often recommended for postmenopausal women to help prevent osteoporosis? Although some research suggests a link between high-dose calcium supplements and heart disease, other research does not. It's best to get your calcium from food. Avoid supplements unless your doctor recommends one. And many people advise no more than one 500 milligram pill per day, taken with food to improve absorption. And finally, here's a brief article called Fixing a Leaky Tricuspid Valve. Once referred to as the forgotten valve, the tricuspid valve has been getting more attention of late. Earlier this year, the FDA approved 2 catheter-based devices for repairing a leaky tricuspid valve. Both devices have been shown to relieve symptoms and improve quality of life for people with moderate to severe tricuspid regurgitation. The 2 valves on the left side of the heart, the aortic and mitral valves, are more likely to develop problems than the tricuspid valve, which separates the upper right and lower right chambers of the heart. But tricuspid valve problems have been underappreciated, says Dr. Shaw, Executive Director of Interventional and Structural Heart Services at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. People can have a lot of leakage from the tricuspid valve for a long time before they start showing any symptoms. A range of issues can cause the tricuspid valve to malfunction, including inborn structural problems, heart infections, atrial fibrillation, and other problems that cause the base of the valve to widen. When the valve leaks, blood can flow backward into the right atrium, causing the heart to beat harder. Over time, the heart enlarges and struggles to function normally. The main symptom is swelling in the legs and lower body, and that's nonspecific, meaning it can result from many different conditions. The most common of these is age-related venous insufficiency, when the legs have trouble carrying blood back up to the heart. But when tricuspid regurgitation is the actual cause, the abdomen may also become distended. Medications that help remove fluid, known as diuretics, can help relieve the swelling and related symptoms of tricuspid regurgitation. Open heart surgery to repair or replace the valve can fix the problem. But by the time people really get into trouble, they're often too sick to undergo surgery. Now, less invasive treatments are an option. Both the newly approved devices are placed in the heart via a catheter passed through an artery in the upper leg. an approach that's long been used to treat aortic and mitral valve problems. One tricuspid device is a modification of a device approved in 2013 to treat mitral valve regurgitation. It works by bringing the valve leaflets together at the area of most severe leakage. The other device delivers a new valve made of cow heart tissue, which is commonly used in surgical valve replacements. Even if a heart ultrasound reveals tricuspid regurgitation, a person might have normal heart function and no symptoms. Do we intervene at that point to prevent long-term complications, or should we wait until they have symptoms and changes in heart function? That's the question experts are currently struggling with. Says Dr. Shaw, right now, people who have symptoms despite taking diuretics are considered possible candidates for one of the catheter-based devices, he says. Ideally, they should be seen at a specialized valve disease center where they can receive additional evaluation to determine if one of the new devices or a more traditional surgery would be the most appropriate treatment. And the article goes on to point out that regurgitation means that valve leaflets do not close properly, causing blood to flow backward each time the heart contracts. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoy it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.